This is Radio Boston. I'm Ticiana Deering, and it's Friday. So we will take some time to dive beneath the headlines on one of the week's big stories. And this week, well, take it away, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu.
And now we'd like to introduce our next Boston Police Commissioner, Michael Cox.
6-month process by the search committee ended with the selection of Michael Cox as the next commissioner of the Boston Police Department. It's an agency he knows well, for better and worse.
He was a Boston police officer for 33 years before becoming the chief in Ann Arbor, Michigan. In 1995, while working undercover in Boston, he was beaten by fellow officers after being mistaken for a suspect.
Sound from NBC News there. Cox says what he went through ultimately will make him a better leader.
I was a victim of some unconstitutional policing, no different than probably incidents that have happened throughout the country to black and brown, people in general.
His selection has been met with a fair amount of praise, including from one of his predecessors, former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis.
We are giving the reins of this police department over to a man that will serve the community and the police officers.
But even Cox himself admits there is a lot for the next leader of the BPD to tackle.
There's some history here, right? It's hard to move forward unless you acknowledge some of that history, right? And we'll acknowledge it, but the fact is we're always trying to move forward to make sure we serve the citizens of Boston well.
So we're going to start to tackle some of that now. Joining us on the line to talk about it, former Massachusetts State Representative Marie St. Fleur, who served on the 11-member Boston Police Reform Task Force. Welcome back, Marie.
Great to be with you, Ticiana.
And here in Studio 2, Kim Janey, mayor of Boston from March to November 2021. Kim, welcome back.
It is great to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. So I'll start with you, Mayor Janey. Reactions to the choice?
Well, I think it is a very interesting choice. We certainly need a leader who can move the police department forward here in Boston. We certainly have made improvements since the mid-1990s, when we know there were so many challenges within the police force. So I'm encouraged, but the job is very big. There are still lots of challenges. We've made improvements, but we cannot kid ourselves to thinking that we have arrived. We know that there is a culture of fear, that there is a blue wall of silence in the police department, and that there are lots of reforms that need to take place. So I'm hopeful, I'm encouraged, and I certainly hope our new commissioner can tackle these problems and will get the support that he needs to do so and lead the department.
So, Marie St. Fleur, when you wear both your community member hat and your police reform task force hat, what's your read on this appointment?
Well, I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged for two reasons. The first reason is that now we've had two folks of color, black males, who have been appointed as commissioner of the Boston Police Department. So it's not an anomaly anymore that it's happened. So it's the second time. And now we have an opportunity to really dig. So since it's not a novelty, it's now we have a chance to really dig deep into the structural issues that's existed in the Boston Police Department for decades. So I think that's a good step. The second step is that you've hired someone who's actually from Boston and from the community, and who has had an experience or knows the history of the Boston Police Department, and in spite of that history, stayed on and moved through the ranks, and so understand how the structural issues that exist within the department has relationships with the existing force and has relationships in the community, then stepped out of it to be able to see how other entities, how other organizations, how other police departments function, and gained some insight there, and now is bringing it back to help move the change forward. So I think all of for those two reasons, I think that there is an opportunity here to really put in place a lot of the reforms that the task force worked on diligently in 2020, 2021. And so I'm excited to see how we move forward.
So picking up on that thread, Kim Janey, Marie just said, he stayed after that beating in 1995 and the cover-up and the force afterward. Here is incoming Commissioner Michael Cox talking about why he stayed and why he decided to stay at the time.
I chose to stay because I believe in policing in a community-friendly way. And I know the men and women that I work with believe in that same thing, too. And the reality is, me leaving was not going to help.
I was struck by that because we happened to talk to former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis at the beginning of the week on a different subject, but guns came up, and he kept going back to how important community policing is in the city of Boston. Do we have a special chance to lean into community policing in some new way with this commissioner, or is this somebody who will undergird what we already do?
Yep. So here's what I would say. One, I think the fact that he experienced the worst of our police department and stood and fought does inform his thinking and will make him a better leader because he understands those challenges from a very personal way. Will he be able to move forward? I certainly hope that he can. I think, you know, there are opportunities to move us forward. The community policing here in Boston has been a national model. I've heard our new commissioner talk about the importance of working with the community, which I support and agree with. But I also think the community needs to see a change within the department. So it's not enough to say we will build relationships with the community. It's not enough to talk about community policing and work with young people. All of those things are incredibly important. But until the community actually sees a change within the department in terms of the culture and some of the reforms that need to take place, it's going to be hard to bridge that relationship.
So I'm going to put together a couple of pieces of sound for us here. First, here's Cox again, incoming police commissioner, with a message to fellow officers about the importance of accountability.
We're going to support you to death. We're going to make sure that you're developed. We're going to make sure that you have all that you need to do this job. You know, but we're also going to hold you accountable for all the things that we ask you to do.
And Marie St. Fleur, I'm going to pair this with some a comment from activist Jamal Crawford. He told WBUR's Deb Becker that he thinks Cox has a lot of qualifications, but isn't necessarily convinced that he'll represent real change.
The one column, the checkbox for me that does not work out is, have you been an active champion for justice, given that you too were a victim of the same system that much of the community has complained about?
So, Marie, I know you served on the police reform task force with Jamal Crawford. React to what you just heard from him, and how effective is that shot across the bow from the incoming police commissioner about accountability in the department?
See, I think that structural change happens when folks who are in there are also willing to stay in there and work it through. It doesn't happen overnight. So, simply a commissioner or a Cox problem. It is a collective problem that we all have to sort of lean into to help with the change. And so he's done what he can. He took his beating in 1995. He fought the fight, had his family attacked, threatened. He, as an individual, went back into that force. Think about it, in 1995, the force that we had, that young man was willing to go back in there and stick it through and fight through. Sometimes you need somebody who's going to be willing to be on the inside to be that example and to really look and understand what the structural issues are and move the change. I think he has done that to the best of his abilities. When I look at the number of areas that he has led within the Boston Police Department, so he has a deep understanding of where the challenges might lie. So I think now the question is, how do we support him? Because obviously, he wasn't able to do it on his own, nor was he the lead. I don't know Michael Cox, but I'm encouraged that he has the breadth of experience that he has, and that he comes with it and with the personal experience that he has, as well as the professional experience that he has. And so what I do think is possible here is that he is going to be able to point out and work with the existing police force, because you have to work with those you have, and work towards those you'd like to bring in, work with the existing police force to bring the change, and he's going to be willing to call it out because now he's the top person in that administration. He's going to be willing to call it out. And I think that is what's exciting, is that he is in a position to call it out and to pull people together to help move the change in very specific ways. The transparency issue, it's really around using the certification process that Post has now made available so that we can actually point out the bad actors and make certain that they're not recertified, right?
So for listeners, POST stands for the Police Officer Standards and Training, which is new, right, in the last couple of years. Marie,
that's
thanks
correct.
For that. So we are talking with former state representative and member of the Boston Police Reform Task Force, Marie St. Fleur, and Kim Janey, former Boston mayor and member of the Boston City Council. I'm going to ask you both to stand by for a minute. I'm going to bring in another voice for just a couple of minutes. Kelly Nee is the chief of police at Boston University. Prior to that, Nee spent more than 33 years with the Boston Police Department. Chief Nee, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So your reactions to the appointment and our discussion so far, Chief Nee?
I think Mayor Janey and Marie said wonderful and insightful things. I think Michael Cox is the perfect person for this moment in time to lead the Boston Police Department and in this new age of reform. And, you know, he's never been a wallflower. I've known Michael for a long time. So even when we were on the command staff at the same time, Michael was always very thoughtful and intelligent and wise, and he never hesitated to bring things up. But I think being in this position as the boss, the commissioner, he will be able to implement some of these things that he has had the vision of for many, many years.
So, you know, one of the things that's interesting in speaking with law enforcement is this window into the inside, what the inside would want from a police commissioner. For example, yesterday we spoke with Larry Ellison, who's a detective in the Boston Police Department and the former president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers. You're a chief in a different context. What do you think the job most requires of a leader?
I think it really requires building trust, right? And Michael addressed that at his press conference. Trust within the department. The department has been through a lot over the past couple of years. Trust with the community is paramount. And I think Michael is in the perfect position to navigate both sides. He understands the challenges within the department, and his lived experience make him so knowledgeable about how to build trust within the community. I think he's going to be really hold people accountable, like he said, to reintroduce members of the police department back to the community and to understand and bring the community in, and how do you want to be policed? That's going to be a critical component.
We're talking about the new Boston Police Commissioner. Right now, we're speaking with Kelly Nee, who's the chief of police at Boston University, but served for decades on the Boston Police Department. Chief Nee, I want to set this question up. As you know, about 2 weeks ago, we saw 100 members of a white supremacist hate group march through the streets of Boston. The police had a thin response, cited concern about optics, about escorting a white supremacist group through the city, and also concerns about suppressing First Amendment rights. But many criticisms about that police response, comparing it to how police responded to protests in 2020 after George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police officers. So in this moment, we know white supremacy threatens our democracy. The FBI has said so. We know it's come to our streets. How would a new police commissioner tackle this, some will argue new, some will argue not at all new, threat to our city?
You're putting me on the spot.
I am.
But I do understand the optic of looking like you're having police officers escort these hate groups. I'm a member of the Governor's Hate Crimes Task Force. You know, hate and violence to solve problems has somewhat been normalized, I think, with the previous administration in the country. So I do understand this optic of looking like you're escorting. There's a big perception that the police are actually part of these groups. I don't see that. I wouldn't tolerate having a member of my department as a member of a hate group. It's intolerable. But it is very challenging, because there are a lot of First Amendment in these groups, and these leaders of these groups know the line of their First Amendment protections, and they will scrape right up against it. But it is very, very challenging. I think having good intelligence about their tactics, and if they're renting vehicles, like whatever intelligence you can get that doesn't infringe on their First Amendment protected rights, helps the city to be in a better position to protect its citizens.
So that's what you would emphasize there, is the intelligence piece especially.
Yes.
All right. That is Kelly New, who is chief of police at Boston University, and before that spent more than 33 years with the Boston Police Department. Chief Nee, always great to have you. Thanks for jumping in with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great to be here.
And still with us as we talk about this moment with the Boston Police Department, Marie St. Fleur, who served on the Boston Police Reform Task Force for the city of Boston, and Kim Janey, former mayor of Boston in 2021. Thanks to both of you for staying with us. Mayor Janey, your reactions there.
You know, we live in very difficult times. And as you point out, these issues are not new. Our police system here in the United States was born out of slavery and slave patrols in the South. Boston is the first actual police department in the nation and recognized this as a public good. But that even was born out of patrols around our shipping industry here. And we know what was being shipped were products that were here because of enslaved individuals. And so that is our history. And as we think about the future of policing, yes, trust is so important, and making sure that there are real meaningful relationships with community. But you can only do that if you're willing to tackle some of the challenges around the blue wall of silence that we have seen in the police department. As recent as last year, we saw officers who felt intimidated and not wanting to share what they know about certain incidents. And so we have to be willing to deal with some of these issues within the department. We have to make sure that, you know, that within the department and beyond throughout the city of Boston, that there is really a relationship of trust. And I'm not sure, I know we don't have that now, and I'm hopeful that Michael can bring us there.
So there's a lot there to pick up on, Marie St. Fleur. Two things that occur to me immediately. One, we did have this cluster of events that have come to the forefront in our hearts and minds over the last 2 years that happened in the 1990s. You have Patrick Rose and the sexual abuse allegations, 2 years on a desk and then reinstated. You have Dennis White, 2 days as commissioner before being put on leave after accusations of domestic violence in the 1990s. Now you have us resurfacing the story of Michael Cox beaten by other officers while he was in plain clothes in 1995, and then years of harassment and intimidation while he tried to seek justice. And that's not including overtime abuse scandals, you know, concerns about police response after the George Floyd protests in 2020. There's so much there culturally, Marie. What's the first lever to push on?
I mean, I think that the good thing is that this new commissioner knows, because you have to have an idea of what is going on inside that building and the structures in order to understand which lever you push on first. My first lever, I would say, is transparency. I mean, you didn't mention the gentleman who, you know, hit an individual who was protesting as it related to George Floyd's death and was bragging about it and just got a suspension and was returned back as a, and again, these are supervisors. These are not line officers that we're talking about. These are supervisors, many of them that we're talking about, you just outlined, or supervisors. So therefore, they're responsible for making certain that there's accountability by the people that who's under their command. And so we really need to take a look at the training of those who are managers, who are supervisors, and really understand whether or not they have the cultural, racial competency to be able to lead in a city as diverse as ours. I mean, I think those, I think the data, I think we need to take a look at the data that we have, make that publicly available so that folks understand that it's not just the police department that's watching, but citizens who pay their salaries need to know what's going on in their police department, because the police department belongs to us, they're public servants, and they need to be they need to be able to be answerable to us, and we won't know what's happening if we don't get the appropriate data to be able to then make the appropriate recommendations, supports, or advocacy actions in order to bring change that is necessary. The other piece that we need to talk about is really looking at the training. Is the training appropriate for the type of city that we have today? We look at Boston as black and white, but Boston is more diverse than that right now. And it's not just black, it's not just white, it's even within those groups, you have to take a look at language issues and cultural issues. And so how are we training people to understand and be supportive so that we don't have mistakes being made because of language issues, because of cultural issues. We make decisions based upon a European model of what is acceptable or what is not acceptable. And so are we looking at how the training is occurring in order to change that? The other piece is, how are we making certain that when we talk about accountability, that at least it's communicated to the residents of this city, how you define accountability as a police department.
Yeah.
And does that match up with what our residents, our citizens believe is accountability, so that we're all working off the same playbook?
Maria,
so I
want to pick it up from there, if you don't mind. And first, just a note for listeners, Clifton McHale is the officer who hit the protester and bragged about it. Thanks to the control room for pulling that name for us. Marie said several things there that I saw you nodding through, Kim Janey, and I'm going to add one more to the mix on this question of accountability. One of the things that's really struck me in the last week, I gave three examples earlier. I gave Dennis White, Michael Cox, Patrick Rose, different stories, all from that same time frame. You referred to the 1990s. Couple of times during this conversation. Paul Evans was the police commissioner during that time, 1994 to 2003, across all of those stories. Often celebrated for low crime rates during that time, reduction in crime rates, et cetera. But is accountability only for this moment forward, or should there be a conversation about past commissioners, past leadership, and that blue wall of silence as it was built during critical times?
You know, I don't know how our new commissioner will approach this, but I think from a community perspective, past injustices are at the forefront of everyone's minds. This might seem like 30 years ago to all of us who reflect on it and read about it in the newspaper, but for individuals who are impacted by these things, they are still living with this to this day, including our new commissioner. So I think when we talk about trust in the community, we have to have that accountability, we have to have that transparency, and we have to be justice-centered. If we're not, and if we're not willing to have honest conversations about some of the challenges of the past that we have experienced as a city, if we're going to try to whitewash it and, you know, act like it wasn't so bad, then I'm not sure we can truly move forward. So I think if we're willing to have those conversations, we have to be honest and we have to be willing to build and move forward. We're not going to hash all of this stuff up just to reopen the wounds. There has to be healing. And the only way we can do that is if we're really focused on transparency, accountability, and justice.
And just very briefly, we've only got a couple minutes left. Who are the outside partners that partner with the Boston Police Department in a conversation like that?
You know, I think it's everyone who is impacted. These are community groups, neighborhood associations. These are young people. These are different groups who organize around identity, whether, you know, cultural or, you know, everyone in the city of Boston. We all pay into people who pay their property tax. That's all how we pay for our public good, whether it be the police, whether it be other public good. So we need to make sure that anyone who wants to be part of that conversation can be part of that conversation. But it has to be structured and it has to be productive. It's not going to be good just to hash up old stuff and then go back into your corners. There has to be a path forward for how we lead, have that conversation in a way that it can be honest but productive and move us forward.
And Marie St. Fleur, last word to you in just a sentence. What are you most hopeful about in this moment?
I am hopeful that we take deep dive into the structure and that we take action. And we have, you know, the Office of Police Accountability, again, in my role in the task force, we actually create a structure that could provide a way to begin to take a deep dive into some of these issues. And so unless we are willing, we can have as many conversations as we want, as we've had conversations on race for I don't know how long that we've been having these conversations at race, but it has to be attached to real structural change.
Yep.
And so when we look at training, we can have a conversation about what are the root causes of why it is that the trainings have occurred the way that they have, and then really look at the levers that we're going to change in order to make that different. And that means it's the type of training you bring in the building. It's who's providing the training. That's going to be, and how are you getting the young officers, the cadets out there to work with community so that they are trained appropriately to be able to communicate, to be able to protect, and to be able to serve in a way that is culturally and racially competent.
All right.
I think that's going to be important. It's really around connecting this conversation that you want to have as you do the excavation that is necessary and to changing of the structures, because the structures are not conducive to racial harmony in the Boston Police Department or to equity in the Boston Police Department, and they need to be changed.
Marie St. Fleur is former Massachusetts State Representative and a member of the 11-person Boston Police Reform Task Force, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and CEO of a cannabis company. And Kim Janey is former mayor of Boston, former Boston City Councilor, and now president and CEO of Empath. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much. And hey, Marie.
Hey, it's great to
be here with you. All right, take care.
Half a gallon of chocolate, half a gallon of chocolate brownie fudge, half a gallon of chocolate chip.
Did your mom really write that shopping list?
Grandpa, what a question.
Chocolate chip. That sounds really good. And of course, that sound right there is from The Simpsons. And we are going to talk ice cream, folks, in this hot, humid weather, especially some unusual flavors. You should see the spread in front of me. I'm sure at some point we're going to take a picture of this, put it in social. So we've got two guests right now. The first, Joe Gatto, who is a local chef and host for the show From Scratch. Joe, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just staring at the ice cream.
It does look really good. And we also have Gus Rancatori, who's owner of Toscanini's Ice Cream in Cambridge, our headphones dropped while we're in the transition. So just for now, just say hi, Gus. And
hello.
In a second, Sydney's going to come on in here right now. We're going to do this in front of everybody, and we're going to get some headphones for you so that we can get started. So while we do that, Joe, I want you to tell me your favorite ice cream memory from childhood.
I mean, it's definitely, I'm sure like a lot of people in Massachusetts, it's going down the Cape, right? Mm-hmm. Down the Cape, the ocean, the beach, black raspberry all day long with my family. You know, I still can taste it and remember it so well. And it's the same for my kids now. They're all addicted to black raspberry. I think those memories are what really drive forward for ice cream for, I think, everybody, right?
Yeah. All right. And how about you, Gus? Favorite childhood memory of ice cream?
I think one of my favorite childhood memories might sound ambiguous or ambivalent, but I'm one of five children, and I remember my father confronting the good humor man who always, you know, wanted to sell us five popsicles. And being a child of the Depression, he was inclined to get those popsicles that could be split in two and divided.
The ones you break in half.
Right. And so, we'd get half a popsicle, and he might take one himself alone. It was kind of a frugal memory of a Depression baby, but that was a long time ago.
So when you then started, Gus, I'll stay with you for a minute, Toscanini's in 1981,
mm-hmm.
did you have some sort of mission for ice cream, having had that experience as a kid?
I'd worked for a long time at a place in Davis Square, Somerville, Steve's Ice Cream, which helped start or revive the idea of homemade ice cream and perhaps many other things. And so I'd worked there for a long time, and what I wanted to do was continue to do what Steve's did, which is make unusual flavors in small batches on site, and that's what we started doing.
All right, so we're going to have some fun with unusual flavors, and I'm going to lead us into that actually with a voice from one of our listeners. Everyone is excited about this segment today. We've gotten lots of, yay, ice cream. So we reached out to our audience through our texting group to ask them about their favorite places and flavors and memories like we've just been talking about. And by the way, if you want to join that texting group, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And Cheryl and Mattapoisett shared this particular memory and flavor.
My husband kind of knows I love ice cream and a little bit of an ice cream junkie. So this is a place called Katie's in Hyannis. And at the end of the season, I had him buy me 5 tubs of lavender honeycomb ice cream. I was absolutely in love with it. And so ever since then, I've been going back. And then eventually I ended up winning one of her contests to create a flavor, and it was glazed donut ice cream.
Okay, so Joe Gatto, maybe I'm just a traditionalist. Lavender honeycomb scares me off a little bit. Glazed donut has me kind of passing out wanting some.
Yeah, I'm going to go all in on that. Yeah, count me in. I want to try that. I want to see what it's all about. I really don't think there's many ice creams I'd turn down, to tell you the truth. I'm all in for all of them. Let's go.
And Gus, is there anything you really can't put in ice cream?
You can put almost anything in ice cream. The question is whether people will enjoy it. And whether the ice cream maker will enjoy it and whether the customer will enjoy it. And at some ice cream stores, I guess I would describe them as having a more transgressive spirit than I really care for. And they're trying to do things that I suspect they intend to annoy your parents or your homeroom teacher with. And at Toscanini's, we're not trying to do that. We may be trying to surprise you. Like, I bet you didn't think this makes a good ice cream flavor. But we're not trying to annoy you.
All right. So, surprise me without annoying me with one of the flavors in front of us, and all three of us are going to try it. What's the first one you want us to try that's a little surprising, Gus?
I think probably grape nut, which is a Caribbean flavor that a lot of customers wonder why we make, but it's very popular because we have a lot of people from the islands.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we put raisins in it, and sometimes we make it straight up with just grape nuts. If you go to Caribbean festivals like in neighborhoods in Brooklyn or even Franklin Park, you're going to see grape nut ice cream everywhere. Sort of surprisingly, grape nut ice cream is also popular with people from northern New England and the Maritime provinces, and I don't understand why there's this geographic discontinuity, but it is kind of an anomaly. So at Toscanini's, we either have people showing up for this flavor who are obviously, who still have Caribbean accents, or people who look like they regular readers of Yankee Magazine.
So here's the thing. I actually grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and as a child loved grape nut ice cream.
Oh, really?
Absolutely loved it. Yeah, and so we're taking some tastes now. Joe, describe what you're tasting there.
I really liked that it had that crunch. I found that textural part of it fascinating, and that made me want more because I wanted to keep trying it. Because we brought one as well that we made last night that's Chipotle espresso.
So, and that's the one in the big tub here. So, folks, listen, we're tasting ice cream in here. We're going to have you hang with us, but I'm not tasting ice cream today. So I'm going to pull this tray over here for a minute. And, Joe, tell us what's in the – this is the Chipotle here,
that's
right?
That's the Chipotle espresso.
I'm trusting you, Joe.
Yeah, please do, because it's going to surprise you. I mean, we wanted to do something different for today. And we also found that with the spice, the Chipotle, which is a smoked habanero and adobo, that the fats from – the, you know, heavy cream and the milk are going to wrap your tongue, so you're going to get a little heat, but it's going to be tasty.
It's so good. I was so skeptical. And yes, all by the way, my mouth on fire a little bit right now.
So you need more ice cream.
Right.
See?
That's right.
See what
it's
I
like,
did there?
It's tricky because you're like, then I need more ice cream, but then you're more on fire. And the espresso just,
Right?
Yep.
That's from my father-in-law, Ben. He does a lot of espresso at the house, so I had a grind there he usually gives me, and I use it for rubs for barbecue and stuff that come up during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we wanted to do something for the show, you know, I wanted to do something kind of off the wall, but make it still where it's, you know, really yummy and kind of addictive. So I loved that I left the Chipotles just with little pieces because
I just
felt
got
like,
a piece.
Right, it chews like a cherry, but you still get that little bit of smokiness and heat with that espresso. I thought they played off each other and gave it what I'm always looking for when I'm cooking is balance.
Yeah. So, Gus, on this plate, what's one that's sort of one of your secret favorites? I want to try that, too.
We sell a lot of Indian ice cream flavors, most commonly called kulfi.
Kulfi?
Which usually kulfi. Has cardamom with chopped almonds and pistachios. But I believe that kulfi actually means frozen dessert. And, you know, because we're in a college town with a lot of South Asian customers, this was kind of an easy flavor to initially sell, and then it showed broadening appeal.
Mm. So I have to tell you, it tastes like a fruitcake if fruitcake tasted good, right? Which I do not think fruitcake take, you know what I'm saying. But this, delicious, the sweet and the cool of it.
If someone gave me this for Christmas, I'd be happy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But, Cassie, what do you think?
Can I give you a taste of this?
Yep. So Joe's daughter is here in the studio. She's a little one, so she's not mic'd, but she's tasting along as we go. Cassie, do I have a thumbs up on that? No, we got a medium thumb.
Medium.
I think this might be an age thing, right? My
palate
was a lot more adventurous. So let's have you both talk about that a little bit. Young palates versus older palates and what people want in ice cream accordingly. Go ahead, Joe.
I mean, I really do think, I mean, we were just talking back and, you know, it is age appropriate. You know, kids want something that's simple, that's yummy, that, you know, where I mean, I do too. I'm still looking for that. But I also like something that challenges my palate and that's interesting and that makes me think, wow, how did they put these flavors together? That last one that you compared to fruitcake, I think that was really complex. And I really liked eating it. It made me want more. And I think that when you get older, you are looking for that. But of course, I'm also looking for that simple, I just want to sit on a wall and just lick a cone of vanilla.
Yeah. Anything in this tray that is along that simpler line that you brought, Gus?
Well, there's French vanilla. And we also brought over two kinds of chocolate ice cream. We brought over a milk chocolate. And we brought over a dark chocolate.
Dark chocolate.
Oh, dark
chocolate. Sorry, did I reveal that out loud? No. I wasn't sure if I kept that to myself or not.
So that's this one.
All right, this is the dark chocolate. I'm going to lean away. I'm leaning away to get my spoon. I'm going to taste it first. Tell us simple ingredients here, Gus.
Most of these ingredients are simple, although they're fairly high quality. So that cocoa pudding ice cream, which is what we call our dark chocolate, is made with imported cocoa from France, I think. And the Belgian chocolate, which is the milk chocolate, is made with chocolate from a famous chocolate company in Belgium. And over the years, we've got all sorts of help in developing flavors from vendors and very informed customers. And I remember these two people who were early distributors to us, and they said, just use different chocolates and you'll get dramatically different flavors. And, sometimes when you're looking at cookbooks or when you're at a restaurant and you wonder, why does this taste so much better than something I could do at home or have done at home? The answer is simply they get better ingredients.
The sourcing, yeah.
Sourcing is really important.
So I got to confess to you, up until this very moment, my all-time favorite ice cream was chunky chocolate pudding from Bedford Farms, which I still love. So shout out to Bedford Farms. But what is this called, Gus, this chocolate thing?
Well, this is just cocoa pudding.
Cocoa pudding. Holy cannoli. So now I think cocoa pudding might now be my favorite. All right. So I'm going to bring us back to the childhood memory a little bit. We got another call from one of our listeners, Richard in Braintree, about memories of making ice cream at home with his dad.
My father was the champion ice cream maker for the whole family. He had a wooden bucket with a hand crank type thing and a metal cylinder into which you would put all of the ingredients. You could put almost anything in there, strawberry, peach, make vanilla if you wanted to. So it was a wonderful treat during the summertime for a young boy and great memories.
So Joe Gatto, you are the From Scratch Chef. You are the make it at home guy.
Yeah.
So I'm completely intimidated about the thought of making ice cream at home. De-intimidate me.
This is just a very simple process. I mean, you're using ingredients that you typically have at home. You're using milks, heavy cream. You can make it simple. I think it's called a Philadelphia style when there's no eggs involved in it, right? And I mean, you can take the eggs out of the equation and just go with simple milk, heavy cream, sugar that you're just melting down into the, you can steep espresso. I mean, the one I made, it took us like 20 minutes to make and then 20 minutes in the ice cream machine. An ice cream machine is going to make it super simple. This is something you can really do with ease at home and still get a really quality product. But I think what Gus said is exactly right. It's all about your ingredients. You want to get the best high quality ingredients and you're going to get a really good product. I mean, this is so easy. It's like making pasta at home. It sounds like it's crazy and it's going to take forever, but it doesn't. It's really simple, very approachable, and great to do with the kids.
All right. And Gus Rancatori of Toscanini's, if one is going to start with a simple flavor, what's your favorite most simple to start with?
I'll change that question and tell you some flavors that I think are hard to make at home, which everyone tries.
Okay.
Strawberry. Strawberries in the United States are grown to be big and durable, and they don't have as much flavor as you might remember if you grew up on a farm or had the fortune to live in France. There are flavors like coffee ice cream or variations on coffee, chocolate, peanut butter. These are kind of rich ingredients that come across very quickly in ice cream. The other thing is if you're only going to make ice cream like once a year or twice a year, because someone gave you an ice cream maker for Christmas and so let's use it this year, you're not going to get very good results. If you make ice cream once a month, it's going to be dramatically better. You're going to become familiar with what you're doing and begin to recognize some of the things that happen.
I think a lot of listeners will be like, okay, so the commission is make ice cream every month at home. It's really the only way to do it.
I got every week out of that. Sorry.
All right. And listen, before we let you go, Joe Gatto, you also accidentally made a vegan ice cream recently. And we have a lot of vegans who listen, so tell us.
Just using coconut milk. And like it just kind of came together really quick with a little vanilla, just coconut milk. I had a little coconut creamer. And next thing you know, we're popping it in the ice cream maker. And again, I think Gus is making so many great points. When you're familiar with what it's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to react, it was really simple. And it came out fantastic.
Delicious.
It was really, really easy. Just a little bit of sugar. That's all we add. Oh, actually, no, it was monk fruit.
Mm. So you didn't even add sugar?
No.
Monk fruit. All right, there you go. Joe Gatto is host of From Scratch. And Gus Rancatori is owner of Toscanini's Ice Cream. It has been a delight, the two of you. Thank you so much.
I'm going to eat all of this ice cream.
There we go. All right, there's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
Yes, it is. And Cristel Aguera, WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter, joins us as usual to give us some things to do around the region this weekend. Cristela, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And this is a little unusual because you're here to tell us about what to do around Greater Boston, but you're not actually here because you're in Mexico City. Why are you there?
My girlfriend's working from here and I'm working from here, and remote work is a fabulous thing, you know?
Amazing. So I have never seen Mexico City. Can you bring us there a little bit? Sights, sounds?
I am so happy to. So what you're hearing is the Mercado de Coyoca. That's Frida Kahlo's hometown. And this is not far from her house, which is called La Casa Azul. And so imagine just people, fruits, really bright colors, really delicious food. I had tacos. I mean, delight. And then outside, there's a bunch of artists selling wares.
So we just did an ice cream segment, Cristela. Have you tried any ice cream since you've been there? And if not, are you going to?
I did not have ice cream, but you know what I had? I had paletas. I had really delicious paletas, popsicles in Mexico City.
Fantastic. All right, so before we go to what to do here, you always have tons of plans. What are you doing in Mexico City this weekend?
So museums. So Mexico City is one of the cities in the world with like the most museums, and I'm trying to get to as many as possible before I head out.
All right. But I know that you also, because you care about our listeners and you're so good to us, you put together some stuff for us around here as well. So I understand we're starting in Somerville.
We are starting in Somerville. So Artbeat 2022, 11 to 10 p.m. Families can come out. It's a multicultural arts festival. So you've got dance, you've got theater, and it looks like 100 street vendors throughout Davis Square with two music stages. If for some reason it rains, it's Sunday at the exact same time. And it's free with a donation.
And that's, did you say 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., right?
It's 11 to 10 on Saturday.
All right. I have not looked at the forecast for the weekend, but given our track record lately, I'm going to assume it's not going to rain out this weekend, and we will probably be on Saturday. All right. I want some more music. Do you have more for us?
I do. We're going to Chinatown in Boston, 3 to 6 on Saturday. This is a celebration called New Narratives, Our Past and Present. So we're talking spoken word, audio movement, and Asian American and Pacific Islander artists. They're going to be at the Mary Suhu Park at the Rose Kennedy Greenway. There's also going to be a piece by Cheryl Wing Z Wong installed in celebration of this year, which is the year of the tiger, according to the Chinese zodiac. So one of the performers is Aino, and they're excellent. They're a Puerto Rican-Cambodia duo called Adobo Fish Sauce. And here's a sample of their style that blends food and spoken word poetry.
How I cook to feel closer to home. How this has nothing to do with who can cook better, and everything to do with the man on the train that yelled, English please, when I was just giving directions to someone in Spanish.
I blame your ignorance. You're poking a finger to see it.
So you say you know the artist.
Yeah, I do. They're homies.
All right, so what else do you have? I think we're going to go the more classical route now.
We are indeed. So this is a show called All Handel. It features music by classical composers George Frederick Handel and the soprano Dominique LaBelle. We'll perform Saturday, so again tomorrow, at St. James Place in Great Barrington. So 7 o'clock, $50 admission, a little cheaper for students at around $15 for those under 30. And there looks like there's also a performance tonight, if you can make it, at 7 p.m. in New York.
And I apologize for asking, but I understand, I'm a little... Indoors or outdoors? I realize I take some of these things for granted in the summer. Is this one indoors or outdoors? Do we know?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. I think indoors, but don't quote me.
All right. We'll see if we can find that out. And I cannot have us have a conversation about Handel without a little bit of sound. So here's a little bit from The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. Although I am going to note that the performances from the group will actually include vocals as well. So if you like a full range of Handel's work, my understanding is there's going to be a lot there to enjoy. Okay, so Christella, one more, not music. Tell us about it.
Not music. This is a movie night.
Movies!
Which in the summer we love, right, movies within the community. But this is going to be aboard Old Ironsides. And you're going to watch a movie on a boat about sailors. It's called Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. It depicts life from the Napoleonic Wars. So we're talking like early 1800s where people traveled and battled on the ocean. And it's free, first come, first serve. Film starts at 8:30, doors open at 7:30. Great for kids.
So we've got a little bit of sound of the battle scene from Master and Commander. And for those of you who sort of like your Oscar nominees, this is Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany, and they are mixing it up.
Let's fly!
Let's fly!
And I don't know why it continues to rock my world that you can continue to see a movie on Old Ironsides, Christella, but I think that is just the coolest thing.
I totally agree. If I was there, I would totally do it.
Yeah, I would too. All right. So Vanessa lets us know that St. James Place is indoors, so the Handel concert will be indoors. Christella, before we let you go, your single favorite sight or sound from Mexico City so far?
Oh, my goodness. I don't even think I could pick that. Sight or sound? I really love the plazas. The plazas with all the people selling wares. I mean, you can find jewelry, you can find everything. And it's really gorgeous. There's a whole culture built around the plazas.
All right. WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter Christella Guerra with some excellent ideas to get you out and enjoying yourself this weekend as she joins us from Mexico City. Christella, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. For the week, I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.